Okay, so the topic for today's lecture is two-parameter bifurcation diagrams. And before I start talking about that, let's just review what a one-parameter bifurcation diagram is. And these are the two that we've studied so far, the saddle node bifurcations and hop bifurcations. So in a one-parameter bifurcation diagram, we plot, say, the steady state level of a variable x against the parameter p. And as the parameter changes, the steady states move around, the steady states can lose their stability, steady states can be born, steady states can die. Okay? And the typical situation is you might have a region of multiple steady states for a certain range of parameters. In this case, two stable steady states and an unstable steady state in between. And that range of bistability is bounded by two bifurcation points. Those are called saddle node bifurcations. And in the other classical case, we have a single steady state, and that steady state loses stability as the parameter increases. It loses stability by a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues crossing the imaginary axis and getting positive real parts. So it loses stability and gives rise to small amplitude limit cycles. That's something called a hop bifurcation. Okay, so that's a one-parameter bifurcation diagram. The y-axis shows you one of the variables of the system, what the variables are doing, and the x-axis shows you a typical parameter, so how the dependence of the dynamics of the system depends upon the parameter. Okay, now let's just remember how we interpret a one-parameter bifurcation diagram. If the parameter value p is small, there's only one steady state. In this case, it's a stable steady state, and I plot here the vector field in the state space, and there's just one place where the vector field is zero, and all the vectors are pointing towards that state. It's a globally, asymptotically stable steady state. If we take a slightly larger value of the parameter in the bistable region, we have two stable steady states separated by an unstable steady state. And as the parameter gets larger still, now we have only a single steady state with a high value of x. Okay, so as the parameter changes, the vector field changes, and the steady states and the stability of the steady states change. Okay, and that's, we try to capture that in a one-parameter bifurcation diagram. Same thing for a hop bifurcation. If we're below the hop bifurcation, we have a stable steady state, which is a focus, and trajectories are spiraling into the stable steady state. And above the hop bifurcation, the steady state is unstable, and trajectories spiral out onto the stable limit cycle. Okay. Now, this is still some more review. I went over this earlier, so I'll just do it quickly. How do we follow steady states as a parameter changes? Okay, so the condition for a steady state is that the right-hand sides of the differential equations are equal to zero. And the right-hand side of the differential equation depends upon the variables x and y, and in general it depends upon some parameter p. And we're trying to get a connection between the variables and the parameters. In this case, we have two algebraic equations to solve, and we have three unknowns. X and Y and P are all unknowns. And in general, this sort of a system has a whole continuum of solutions. You have two equations and three unknowns. There should be continuous curves that describe the relationship. And the way we find that relationship is we have to assume that we know one solution to this system. We know a solution x naught, y naught, and p naught. And then we want to find other solutions that are close to the known solution. So typically what you do is you expand the algebraic equations using Taylor's theorem, and the first part is equal to zero because it's a steady state, and we only keep the linear terms and we neglect the nonlinear terms. So we're just looking close to the known solution, and we can find new solutions close to the known solution by satisfying these linear algebraic equations. And those are easy to solve. We just write it in this fashion. it's perfectly generalizable to any number of variables and one parameter and any number of variables. And the condition that we can solve this algebraic equation is just that the determinant of the Jacobian matrix evaluated at the steady state be non-zero. Because then we can calculate the inverse of the Jacobian matrix and solve for the variables as a function of the parameter, or how far the parameter is from the known solution. Okay? So with this equation, we can follow a steady state as a parameter changes. And then every once in a while, we just update the Jacobian as we move further and further away from where we started. So we can move along a locus of steady states as the parameter changes, as long as the determinant of Jacobian matrix isn't zero. So as we're doing this, as we move along the steady states, we're all the time calculating the Jacobian matrix, well, we might as well calculate the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix and keep that track of the eigenvalues and see what they're doing, okay? So we want to make sure we never get a zero eigenvalue. That's when the determinant of the Jacobian is equal to zero. We get a zero eigenvalue. Or if we have a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues, we want to keep track of the real part. So we just monitor the eigenvalues, or the determinant of the Jacobian matrix, as we follow the steady states. And whenever the determinant is equal to zero, or whenever we have a real eigenvalue equal to zero, we know we've located a saddle node bifurcation point. And whenever the real part of the leading eigenvalues, if they're complex conjugate pair, whenever the real part is equal to zero, we know we've found the Hopf bifurcation. Okay? So this is what the software does. Software just carries out these calculations and plots the bifurcation curve, and whenever it sees a bifurcation point, a saddle node bifurcation or a Hopf bifurcation, it leaves a little mark at that point. And then you can go back and you can investigate the bifurcation point. So in particular, wherever you have a Hopf bifurcation, there the steady state changes its stability, you go back and you grab that Hopf bifurcation and you can ask the software to follow the periodic solutions as they bifurcate away from the Hopf bifurcation. And in this way, we can construct one parameter bifurcation diagrams numerically. Okay, so now we should be set up to talk about two parameter bifurcation diagrams. Do you have any questions about how you calculate a one parameter bifurcation diagram? Okay. We're trying to follow the steady states. You have n equations in n variables, and then you have one extra unknown, which is your parameter. So we're using what's called the implicit function theorem to get that relationship between the variables and the parameter. So a two-parameter bifurcation diagram is computed in exactly the same way. Now, suppose we want to follow a saddle node bifurcation and see what happens to a saddle node bifurcation as some other parameter changes. Other parameter besides this parameter P. Okay? So what does it mean to follow a saddle node bifurcation? Well, first of all, it has to be a steady state. So you have to satisfy the algebraic equations for a steady state. And secondly, it has to be a saddle node point, which means the determinant of the Jacobian matrix has to equal zero. And all of these things are functions of the variables and of now the two parameters. So now we have three equations that we're trying to satisfy, and we have four unknowns. So again, that defines a relationship between any two of them. And the relationship we want to find is the relationship between the second parameter Q and the first parameter P. So again, we expand things in a Taylor series. We keep just the linear terms, and we write these linear algebraic equations for following the saddle node bifurcation in a second parameter. And we solve this equation for Q as a function of P, and that gives a locus. It gives a one dimensional curve in the parameter space, PQ parameter space, and typically if you follow a saddle node bifurcation, you move along this line and it comes up to these very typical cusp points, and then you follow the line off in a different direction. And what's the meaning of this diagram? Within the cusp region, that's the place where you have three steady states. And the region of three steady states is bounded by saddle node bifurcation. So you have a saddle node bifurcation on this side and a saddle node bifurcation on this side. Outside the cusp region, you have only one steady state. And this line that you follow when you solve these equations, the line that you're following is called a fold line, because that's where the one parameter bifurcation diagram folds on itself, where the saddle and the node come together. And this characteristic point at the top where the two fold lines come together is called a cusp point. And some more terminology. The fold line is called a codimension 1 bifurcation, and the cusp point is called a codimension 2 bifurcation. So let me just remind you what this terminology means. What's a bifurcation point? A bifurcation point is a particular combination of parameter values where something qualitatively funny happens to the solutions of the differential equations. On one side of the bifurcation point, you have one kind of behavior, and on the other side of the bifurcation point, you have a different qualitative behavior of the solutions of the differential equations. Okay? So something qualitatively important happens at a bifurcation point. And now we're distinguishing between codimension 1 bifurcation points and codimension 2 bifurcation points. A fold line or a saddle node bifurcation is a codimension 1 bifurcation point because I can choose any values I want of the n-1 parameters, but I need one parameter that I can twiddle. And if I twiddle one parameter, I can eventually find the bifurcation point. Okay? So there are a whole bunch of parameters. You need one of them in general. I need freedom to change one of them in general to find a codimension 1 bifurcation point. So if I fix Q and I change P, I can find two fold lines for particular values of P. If I fix P and vary Q, I can also cross the fold line. I can find the bifurcation point. Okay? But the cusp point, something even stranger happens at the cusp point. That's a codimension 2 bifurcation point. In order to find the cusp, I have to have the freedom to choose P and to choose Q. I need to be able to adjust two parameters to find the cusp point. And in principle, there are higher dimension bifurcations. There should be codimension 3 and codimension 4 bifurcations, but they're not very well understood from a mathematical point of view. It's the codimension 1 and codimension 2 bifurcations that are most well understood mathematically. You with me so far? Yes, question. Yes, a third axis. What do you want to put on the third axis? You want to put one of the variables, x. That's what I'm going to do next. Okay? I'll get to it in just a second. Okay, so now here I want to talk about how you interpret a two-parameter bifurcation diagram. You interpret a two-parameter bifurcation diagram in terms of one-parameter bifurcation diagrams. Okay? So if I fix Q and I change P, then at this level, then I will see our typical one-parameter bifurcation diagram with a region of bistability. Because I start here with small value of P and a low value of X, I move into the bistable region, and then I move out of the bistable region, and now the variable X has its large value. Okay? So notice that there's single stable steady state outside the cusp, and inside the cusp there's two stable steady states and a saddle point. And now I'm using this notation. An S means there's a steady state, and the S means it's stable. If it were unstable, I would use the letter U to mark the steady state. And saddle, for saddle points, I use the letter X. Okay? So this is a stable node, a saddle point, and another stable node. And as I cross a fold line, an X and an S annihilate each other and just leave you with one S. Okay? So that's the rule for moving around on the two-parameter bifurcation diagram. Now, if I do this at a higher value of Q, I don't pass through the cusp region. I don't see any bistability in the one-parameter bifurcation diagram. I just see a smooth increase in the steady-state value of the variable X as the parameter P increases. Okay? So if you have a system with positive feedback that can generate bistability, it won't generate bistability for any old values of the parameters. You have to choose the parameters right so that you can cut through the cusp region, because the bistability only exists in a certain domain of the parameter space. And now what happens if we cut right at the cusp point? If we cut right at the cusp point and plot X as a function of P, we don't see bistability, but we see a very steep increase of the variable X as a function of the parameter P. In fact, the slope of this line is infinite as we pass through the cusp point. Okay? And that's why it's a codimension 2 bifurcation. If you think of the slope of the plot of X versus P, if I'm above the cusp point, the slope is positive, right? If I cut through the bistable region, the slope is negative because we have that region of unstable steady states. And when I cut right through the, If I cut right through the cusp point, then the slope is infinite. Okay. Now, a little bit more terminology. All cusps look the same. In a nonlinear dynamical system with nonlinear ODEs, well-behaved ODEs, if you have fold lines and bistability somewhere, you're going to find cusps, and all cusps look the same. They have this feature. They the sharp cusp point. Inside the cusp, you have two nodes and a saddle point, and outside you have just a single stable steady state. And this is sometimes called the universal unfolding of the cusp point. It's universal because all cusp points look the same. If you take a magnifying glass and look close enough to the cusp point, they all look like this. Okay, now I want to get to Arun's question. We have a third axis we could use, okay? And I want to use it to plot a variable as a function of two parameters. But first, let's just start with a one-parameter bifurcation diagram with X as a function of P. And suppose our bistable region looks like this. It's got a saddle node for positive value of P, and it has a saddle node for negative value of P. But we're not going to explore the negative region. Instead, what I want to do is introduce a second parameter, Q. Okay? So here's the bifurcation diagram that I was showing you. X as a function of P, it has a saddle node bifurcation and two stable steady states. And then if I plot X as a function of a second parameter, Q, in a different direction, I might see the completion of that bifurcation diagram. So those are two cuts, two different one-parameter bifurcation diagrams. And I want to ask, what does this relationship look like for X as a function of P and Q inside this this region of parameter space? And in general, the curves always look the same. If you fill out X as a function of P and Q under this sort of a setup, you find that you're viewing a surface now in three dimensions. There's one relationship between them that defines a surface in three dimensions, and that surface is a pleated sheet. It has a pleat in it. Where the pleat is where the bistable region is. But that pleated region comes together in the cusp point. And there are two surfaces to the pleat. There's the upper surface where the value of x is high, and there's the lower surface where the value of x is low. And of course, there's the intermediate surface of the pleat. That's where you have the unstable steady states. So if you can see that, that's what the full two-parameter bifurcation diagram looks like. But usually, we just press the pleat down onto the two-parameter bifurcation plane, and we suppress the x-axis. But in your mind's eye, you have to be able to see that pleated sheet that lies above the cusp-shaped region. Okay. So, if I go kind of in this direction across the bifurcation diagram, I go from high x through a bistable region and then come out the other side on the bottom sheet of the surface. But I could avoid the bistable region altogether by increasing p at high q and then decreasing q at high p. I can go around the cusp and I can go smoothly from high x through medium x to low x. Depends upon what trajectory I take, how I change the parameters, how the system is going to behave. So these are all curious properties of systems with bistability. And these are all very generic properties. It doesn't depend upon the specific biochemical mechanism that you assume. Anything sensible that can generate bistability is ultimately going to give you pictures that look like this. Okay, you with me? So let's talk about the two-parameter bifurcation diagrams for Hopf bifurcation. So we do the same thing. To get a two-parameter bifurcation for a Hopf bifurcation, we have to solve the steady-state equations, and we have to solve an additional condition, which is that the real part of the leading eigenvalues, a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues, that the real part is equal to zero. So again, I have three equations in four unknowns, and I can use that to plot a locus of Hopf bifurcations in two parameters, parameter Q versus parameter P. And generally, what you see for Hopf bifurcations is that the locus of Hopf bifurcations kind of closes on itself to define a domain inside of which the steady state is unstable and there's a stable limit cycle that surrounds the unstable steady state. And outside of that closed region, there's only a single stable steady state. And the steady state changes from stable to unstable whenever I cross that locus, because that's the locus of Hopf bifurcation. And it doesn't matter what direction I cross it in, okay? So it's a codimension one bifurcation. I can fix Q and increase P. I can fix P and increase Q. I can increase Q and P at the same time. I'll always cut through this region. It's a one parameter bifurcation. Codimension one bifurcation. And how do we interpret it? If we fix Q and increase P, we start in a region with a single stable steady state. It loses stability, and these small amplitude limit cycles bifurcate away from the Hopf bifurcation. They grow in size, but then they shrink again, and they're lost at the Hopf bifurcation on the other side, and now the steady state regains its stability. So as a function of one parameter, you'd kind of move through the oscillatory domain. The oscillations would be born, they grow up, and then they'd shrink away and disappear at higher values of P. Okay? So that's how you interpret the two-parameter bifurcation diagram when there are Hopf bifurcations. Okay? But remember, there are two kinds of Hopf bifurcations. There are the supercritical Hopf bifurcations that give rise to stable limit cycles. And there's also the possibility that you can have a subcritical Hopf bifurcation which gives rise to unstable limit cycles. And the usual way that these things fit together is at a subcritical hop bifurcation, you get unstable limit cycles. And if you follow those unstable limit cycles, they disappear at a bifurcation called a cyclic fold bifurcation, where a locus of unstable limit cycles coalesces with a locus of stable limit cycles, and the two limit cycles annihilate each other. So just like steady states can come together and annihilate each other, a node and a saddle point can come together and annihilate each other and just disappear at a saddle-node bifurcation, it's also possible for stable limit cycles and unstable limit cycles to come together and annihilate each other at a cyclic fold. It's sometimes called a saddle node of periodic orbits. That's the different name for the same thing. A saddle node of periodic orbits, because they come together and annihilate each other. Or a cyclic fold. Remember, a saddle node is sometimes called a fold. And this is a cyclic fold because it's a fold of periodic orbits. Okay? So that's the terminology. And you can see now how nicely these things fit together. From the Hopf bifurcation on the left gives rise to small amplitude, unstable limit cycles, which then change their character and they become stable, large amplitude periodic orbits, but you have to follow them in the opposite direction. And then, as the parameter P increases, those large amplitude, stable periodic solutions lose amplitude and disappear at that supercritical Hopf bifurcation. Now, you know, of course, now you can play all different kinds of games. This could be a subcritical Hopf bifurcation as well up here, or this could be some kind of a homoclinic bifurcation that gives rise to limit cycles. Okay, because this is now like a Lego set. We have different kinds of pieces. We have saddle node bifurcations, subcritical, supercritical Hopf bifurcations. We have homoclinic orbits, saddle loop bifurcations, and SNC bifurcations. These are all little components that can now be hooked together in different ways in one parameter bifurcation diagrams. And the two parameter bifurcation diagrams tell you the legal ways that you can hook together the one parameter, the codimension one bifurcations. So let me try to explain that in this situation. What does the two parameter bifurcation diagram look like for this case of a one parameter bifurcation? Okay, so now we have parameter P and parameter Q, and we have loci of bifurcation. So here's a locus of supercritical Hopf bifurcations. Here's a locus of subcritical Hopf bifurcations, and here's a locus of cyclic fold bifurcations. And the theorem says that these three different types of bifurcations have to come together in a very special way at a codimension 2 bifurcation that's called a degenerate Hopf bifurcation. Okay? So just compare this to the cusp. At a cusp, two fold lines come together, and they come together in a very special way, in this cusp-shaped structure, where the two fold lines come together tangentially to each other. That's why it looks like a sharp point, because they come together tangent to each other. And I said all cusps look the same. There's a universal unfolding of cusps. And they all look the same, close to the cusp point. Here's our second example of a codimension 2 bifurcation, a degenerate Hopf bifurcation. And if you just focus on what's happening close to that degenerate Hopf bifurcation, they all look the same. This is the universal unfolding of a degenerate Hopf bifurcation. And what happens at a degenerate Hopf bifurcation? That's where a supercritical, that's where it changes its character from being supercritical to being subcritical. where the small amplitude limit cycles change from being stable limit cycles on one side of the bifurcation to being unstable limit cycles on the other side of the bifurcation. And when the small amplitude limit cycles change their stability, necessarily there has to be a new branch of bifurcation points, of cyclic fold bifurcation points, that branches off from the codimension 2 bifurcation. So that has to be there. Now I can kind of diagram what's happening around the unfolding of a degenerate Hopf bifurcation. In the region outside, you have a single stable steady state. So I label that with an S, a single stable steady state. When you cross the Hopf bifurcation, that stable steady state becomes an unstable steady state because a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues, the real part, they cross the imaginary axis. So now the steady state is unstable. So it changes from S to U. And if you cross a supercritical Hopf bifurcation, that unstable steady state is surrounded by a stable limit cycle. So I put a little solid circle around it. That's the stable limit cycle around the unstable steady state. But in this little region between the subcritical Hopf bifurcation and the cyclic fold, I have a stable steady state that's surrounded by an unstable limit cycle, the dashed circle, and outside the unstable limit cycle is a stable limit cycle. And if I start in this region and move to the left and cross the cyclic fold line, what happens? As I cross the cyclic fold line, the unstable limit cycle gets bigger, the stable limit cycle gets smaller, until right at the fold line, those two limit cycles coalesce and annihilate each other, and you're just left with a stable steady state when you're on the far left of that bifurcation curve. If I'm going in the other direction, then as I cross the cyclic fold, two limit cycles appear out of the blue. Okay? And if I keep following at increasing value of P, I cross the subcritical Hopf bifurcation, and what happens is the small amplitude unstable limit cycles shrink down onto the stable steady state, and then they cause a change of stability of the steady state from stable to unstable, and the small amplitude limit cycles disappear. And I get back to this picture. Okay? And if I do a one parameter bifurcation, fixing Q at this value and increasing P, then what I'll find as P increases, I pass a cyclic fold and two limit cycles appear. Then I pass a subcritical Hopf bifurcation and the small amplitude unstable limit cycles disappear. The steady state becomes unstable. And then at higher values of P, I cross a supercritical Hopf bifurcation. And I lose the limit cycles and go back to a stable steady state. Okay? So to use these bifurcation diagrams, you have to get familiar. You have to practice on these things and ask yourself, well, what will I see if I change this parameter at this point? What will the one parameter bifurcation diagram look like? But I hope you can see the power of this methodology. What we're trying to capture is always the nature of the vector field. So let me just go back to the early lectures where I stressed that our model, we have in our minds some mechanism, some molecular control system in cell biology, right? And I said that diagram of the interactions among those molecules is trying to define a set of nonlinear differential equations that determines the time rate of change of all those interacting proteins and genes. And those differential equations describe a vector field in the state space, and that vector field in the state space determines the attractors and repellers of the control system. You can have steady state attractors, you can have limit cycle attractors, You can have steady state repellers, you can have limit cycle repellers. And we're trying to characterize the nature of those attractors and repellers of the vector field, because those things determine what the physiological behavior of the cell is going to be. Is it going to sit at a steady state? Is it going to go through some transient perturbation? Is it going to jump onto a limit cycle? Those are all important from a physiological point of view. We want to know what those attractors and repellers are. And bifurcation theory is the natural way to describe the attractors and repellers of the vector field. And I've shown how to draw one parameter bifurcation diagrams, and now how to draw two parameter bifurcation diagrams. The one parameter bifurcation diagram you can always interpret. You pick a value of P, you make a cut, and you can imagine what the vector field looks like. The two parameter bifurcation diagram gives you more information still. It shows you how things fit together as two parameters change. And you interpret it by making cuts and getting one parameter bifurcation diagrams and making cuts of them and getting back to the state space. Or we can use this little notation that I've introduced on this two parameter bifurcation diagram, and kind of just in the different regions of the two parameter bifurcation diagram, we can indicate what the vector field looks like, or at least what the attractors and repellers of the vector field look like, in a very compact little notation. And we see that these curves on the two-parameter bifurcation diagram divide the region up into little zones, and in each zone, the vector field has a specific qualitative behavior. And it only changes that behavior when you cross a locus of bifurcations. So we're able to fit together everything we know about the system in this two-parameter bifurcation diagram. Now, that bifurcation diagram wasn't complete. If I finish off the bifurcation diagram, in general, it would look something like this. The locus of Hopf bifurcations closes on itself, okay, to form an egg-shaped region with an unstable steady state inside, surrounded by stable limit cycle. But the Hopf bifurcations, half of the egg are supercritical Hopf bifurcations, and the other half are subcritical Hopf bifurcations. They're separated by two degenerate Hopf bifurcations. And at those degenerate Hopf bifurcations, we get a locus of cyclic folds. And if we follow the locus of cyclic folds, they'll eventually come around and connect to the other degenerate Hopf bifurcation. But in general, now, I think you can figure out how you would follow a locus of cyclic folds. It's the same sort of a thing. You're going to have three conditions in four unknowns, and you're going to use the implicit function theorem and follow the locus of cyclic folds. And in general, what happens, these things can go through cusps because they're fold lines, and fold lines can have cusps in them. And who knows how many cusps it has, but eventually that fold line is going to disappear at a degenerate Hopf bifurcation somewhere. Okay? The number of cusps that you see certainly depends upon the system that we're solving. Okay? Yes, Johnny? These cusp points are codimension 2 bifurcations. That's right. I don't know that they have a lot of significance, really, but you just should know that that's what it's going to look like. Don't be surprised. Okay? But notice that when you have a full bifurcation diagram, all the pieces will fit together, and you'll see that the puzzle is finished. It's just like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. You know, you can tell when the jigsaw puzzle isn't finished yet, right? Because you got a gap in it. You got pieces that you got to pick parts of the picture that don't fit together. And when you finally have the whole picture together, all the little pieces fit together, and the picture that they create is a satisfying picture, right? So this is a complete bifurcation diagram. All the pieces fit together. Everything is consistent. Now, there are bifurcation diagrams that are much more complicated than this one, with many more pieces, right? This is just a simple kindergarten kind of a jigsaw puzzle with a few pieces. But if we continue this lecture series, we'll see much more complicated two-parameter bifurcation diagrams with hundreds of pieces, and it sometimes can be quite difficult to find all the pieces and get everything to fit together. Okay? So, I haven't talked about all the different kinds of codimension 2 bifurcations yet. There are a number of other important codimension 2 bifurcations that allow the codimension 1 bifurcation curve to fit together in other ways. So I hope you can see that that's what we need to do next. We need to introduce some additional codimension 2 bifurcation so we can see other ways that the pieces of these jigsaw puzzles can fit together. And the next one to consider is the what's called the Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation. It's a very interesting and important kind of a codimension 2 bifurcation, but considerably more complicated than this. But it's a bifurcation that we see all the time in our models of these control systems, so it's important that we understand it. So that's what I intend to do in the next lecture. But as I was saying at the beginning of this lecture, I'm going to be away for 3 weeks. So we won't meet for the next 3 weeks. So you have to remember a month from now to come back. But I would encourage you to send me an email, okay? Because I don't know if I'll remember everybody. And then I can send out a reminder. And we may not meet here. We may just meet over in my office and see how much further we want to go. But I really think we better talk about Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation because that's a very important one. Okay. Any questions? So we'll meet in another month, and I'll send out an email to remind people. Okay, thanks.